the extended podcast of New Classical Tracks. I'm Julie Amacher. In this episode, you'll find out more about Avi Avital and his collaboration with Omar Avital as they explore their Moroccan ancestry. You'll learn about his instrument, how he helped to create it, and what he's up to, what he's most excited about in this upcoming season, and how his 4-year-old son stole the stage recently. It's all just ahead. I hope you enjoy it. So it's interesting to me, as I'm looking at sort of the trajectory of your career, you seem to really be willing to kind of explore all kinds of things that would probably push you out of your comfort zone, I'm guessing.
Yes, I think it's a combination of the nature of my instrument, the mandolin, which really, like when I realized I'm beginning a career as a classical mandolin player, obviously there were no examples of that that I could take from previous mandolin players who played classical concerts, or there weren't so many at least. And so it forced me, quote-unquote, to be very creative of what I do and to really be always on an exploration mode. This is the best part of it for me. And it means that the whole, keep inventing kind of the path that I'm walking on. And also my nature as a very curious person, I think, has always been, and I always liked to listen to and to play a little bit different genres of music and really to get, and some of them I get confident enough even to go on stage with them. Like klezmer music and the recent project I did with jazz musicians, with Omar Avital, and with world music. And yes, I think it's all, you know, all these genres that at bottom line, they're all dialects of the same language.
What has surprised you the most so far in your career of what you've been able to accomplish with this little instrument?
What surprised me the most?
Yeah, I mean, maybe that question needs to be turned around. Maybe you've discovered that you have surprised others with what you're able to do. I don't know.
Oh, I hope so. I didn't really think of it. I mean, in terms of really career, I think the Grammy nomination came as a very pleasant surprise. It came out of the blue. I remember this December morning where I switch on my phone and look at the emails, and I have like 30 emails with the subject congratulations. I say, like, wait a second, my birthday is in October. Why do all these people congratulate me? And I discovered that over the night in LA, the nomination at least was announced, and that was one of them. That was a milestone, obviously, for myself personally, but also for the mandolin, or at least the classical mandolin, was the first time that it was included in a nomination list for the Grammy. But this is, you know, the career thing is obviously pleasant and nice, and I'm proud of my achievements. But the main thing, the reason why I play music to people, is obviously not for my my mother's pride or my own pride, but it's really to serve the people who come to the concert with great art, with beautiful music, with hopefully sometimes a spiritual experience, an experience of art. This is why I am a musician. This is why I travel the world. To serve all the people that are coming to experience that artistic experience, and hopefully to offer them, and in the context of playing the mandolin in a concert hall, something which they might not have heard before. When I go on stage, I think 80%, I know that 80%, 90% of the public have never heard the mandolin played live before, and this is a great energy to walk on stage on with, because you allow them that discovery, you allow them to listen to something that is new in a context of a traditional form of art, and this is very exciting for me.
I want to ask you about your mandolin, which you refer to as your voice, because you had a hand in crafting this instrument. Can you share that story with us, please?
Yeah, so first, just a little background. The mandolin, I think, is the only instrument in the world that I know that still comes in very different forms. I mean, if you look at the flute or the violin and you go to Japan, you go to North America, you go to Europe, they more or less look the same, more or less sound the same. With the mandolin, it's quite different because it always was a very popular instrument, but as an amateur instrument. And it was connected with different genres of music. We know in North America, obviously, it's mostly used for bluegrass. In Brazil, it's for shore music, and so on. So there are different aesthetics of sounds. There are different forms of the mandolin. The American mandolin is, we recognize like the F shape after the Gibson model. That's what usually bluegrass players use. But in Italy, the traditional mandolin is the Neapolitan one with a little belly that everyone knows from, old photos. And it's very interesting that really everywhere you go in the world, there's different shapes to the same instrument. And this has also allowed me and the maker of the instrument that I'm playing, Arik Herman, to not be conditioned by any tradition. His goal was to create a mandolin which would fit a 21st century concert hall, modern concert hall, big concert hall, that would be loud enough, that would be rich of range and colors like all the other classical music instruments that we encounter every day in a concert hall. It's a development that took about 20 years. It's 20 years since I bought my first mandolin from him. And I still, every time I go to Israel, I visit in his studio, we talk about it, we keep exploring. I would take the mandolin, I say, Arik, I want more basses. And he would take it in to his studio and do something inside. And I would hear like some machinery working, and would come back and the mandolin would have more basses. And then I would complain that I want more, a bright high notes, and he would do that. So we both very much into exploration, into fitting and developing the mandolin into the modern concert hall.
I read an interview with you where you stated, I think that everyone has some kind of connection to the mandolin. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yes, I think, a plucked string instrument, a string attached to a soundboard, making a sound either with a finger or with a plectrum, piece of wood, a piece of plastic, whatever it is a very intuitive and a very ancient form of instrument making. I mean, the most ancient instruments in the world are melodic, are plucked string instruments. For comparison, a bow instrument is much later. It comes much later in the evolution of musical instruments, and much, let's say, less intuitive. That's why if we look at every culture, every musical culture, as ancient as it may be, all around the world, there's always a plucked string instrument playing the main role. In Greek music, it's the bouzouki. In Russian music, it's the balalaika. In China, it's the pipa. It's the sitar in Indian music. It's the banjo and the mandolin in American music, and so on and so forth. You go to Africa, South America with the charango, Asia, they're all plucked string instruments. And therefore, I had a feeling when I play in my concerts, for example, a Russian piece, people would come to me after the concert and say, wow, that sounds very Russian. If I play Italian music, they would come and say, wow, that sounds very Italian. So it has this kind of chameleon aspect to it, thanks to the tradition and thanks to the broader family of instruments that are really rooted in almost every culture in the world.
So you've explored the music of Bach and Vivaldi, and you traveled between worlds, and now on your new recording, your fourth release, you're returning to your homeland with perhaps an unlikely musical companion. Tell me a little bit about this jazz bassist with whom you've teamed up with.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is quite an unusual album in my discography, which I'm really proud of, and I really wanted to do for many years. And for this, it's a very personal one. Omer Avital, the bass player with whom I collaborated on this project, is a jazz musician and a composer. He lives in New York, but he's obviously from Israel. We share the same family name, but disclaimer, we're not blood related. However, the fact that we have the same family name is also not completely a coincidence. Avital is a typical surname of Moroccan Jewish families. So both of us were born in Israel, but in our ancestry, my parents came from Morocco, his father came from Morocco. We have that tradition, we have that culture, that mentality, that music we grew up with, which is similar and very special. And, you know, until now, when playing classical music, playing Bach, Vivaldi, that aspect, I mean, the music that I grew up with, the Moroccan rhythms, didn't really play a role or play the minimal role when I go and perform classical music on stage. But it kind of bubbled inside all these years, and I always wanted to do something with it. And it's really like a native language to me. And so it is for Omer. And so at the beginning, we thought it would be bringing two worlds, the classical and the jazz, together, and let's see what happens. But what we discovered is that we have much, much more in common than we expected. And that's the turn that the album took. There are a lot of Moroccan, Middle Eastern music reference to it. You can't really call it jazz. You can't really call it classical music, but it's all original music that we both composed and that reflect this mixture and this cultural baggage that we all collected in our, each one in his own journey.
Now, how did the two of you meet? Was it at a music festival a few years ago?
Yes, I know Omer for many years, from before that. We met in the Music Academy in Jerusalem, which is, again, a very a special place where there are classical music department, but also Arab music department and jazz department. And one of the school that you really get exposed to a lot of different forms of music making. And that's where we first met, and we became really friends. I have to say that every time that I performed in New York, Omer came to listen to the concerts. I would go to the Smalls or Joe's Pub to listen to his gigs, and we kept this friendship and kind of a mutual admiration towards each other's work. And we always were kidding about the idea of, oh, we're both Avitals, we have to do something together, until the opportunity came, as you said, a couple of years ago, from a music festival in Bremen in Germany, who commissioned, actually they asked me to perform a concert, but with something that I've never done before, and they kind of asked me to go wild with my ideas. So I thought to myself, this is my opportunity to do really something that I've never dared to do before, and to see what will happen. And that was a fantastic experience to make this concert together. And it took this extra 3 or 4 years to put it on record and to go on tour again.
We should mention that there is also an Israeli pianist and percussionist joining you on this recording. Would you like to say anything about those musicians?
Yes. So although this project started as a dialogue of two people, we reinforced it with two other brilliant, genius musicians who are the jazz pianist Yonatan Avishai and the percussionist Itamar Doari. Itamar Doari comes from the Middle Eastern hand percussion tradition, although he took it to a very, let's say, very advanced places artistically. And I feel that they gave a lot. There is a lot of them also in the album. We worked in the studio. It was an acoustic recording, so we were all in the same room, no walls, no channels, no click track. It was all coming very natural and very organically from the band, from everyone's input, and everyone's world was peered into this recording, and therefore, of course, their role in this album, in the project, in our tours is very prominent, is very evident.
You talk about how, you know, you're blending Moroccan beats, Israeli harmonies, improvisation, and a classical sensibility. How does that classical sensibility come through in this music?
Well, a lot of the expression tools in classical music are those nuances, really tools that were lost a little bit in popular music, rubato, a very wide range of colors, of dynamics, and also the general approach to it. As I said, we were recording as we're sitting like a string quartet. We were sitting in the same room, really tuning ourselves into doing chamber music, being very sensitive to what the other plays, and to extreme those this palette of expression tools, like this is for me bread and butter when I play classical music, not necessarily for any jazz musician, or not even to mention pop music and so on, which I have lots of respect to, but it just those elements were kind of my input into this project. I think the way, for example, I approached melodies in the two ballads, like Ballad for Ellie and Lonely Girl, were like that. I mean, I would play a melody by Brahms and or Schumann with the same intention, with the same skills and experience that I've developed as a classical musician.
What else is coming up that you're most excited about in the next few months or in the upcoming season?
Yeah, oh, so many things. I'm talking now from Schleswig-Holstein, which is the northern region in Germany. I'm here for 2 months as artist in residence at the Schleswig-Holstein Music Festival. It's one of the biggest music festivals in the world, meaning that I'm playing here 20 concerts throughout the summer with 10 different projects. So in other words, practically everything that I have in my repertoire, plus 3 new projects. This is my summer. This is what my summer looks like. It's very exciting and dynamic. And so there are a lot of new projects that are born this summer in this occasion. And I'm coming to the States in November to tour with the Knights, a wonderful chamber orchestra from Brooklyn. And yeah, the usual orchestral concerti. We tour again with Avital Mitza Vital in Europe in October. It's very dynamic, I have to say.
Yeah. Does your son get to work in here somehow? You mentioned him. I'm thinking, holy smokes, he must be small to be able to, you know, maybe he travels with you or something.
No, well, they're all here. I mean, I brought for this residency, I'm here. We usually live all together in Berlin, but for this summer, July and August, we actually moved to Lübeck, where I'm calling from, and it's a lovely little, gorgeous little town in northern part of north of Hamburg, and we're here, and of course, it's an opportunity also for my son to come to many concerts. The first concert, he insisted to actually go and take the bow with me, the final bow with me on stage, and everyone were laughing, and I think he enjoyed himself as well here.
Oh, I bet that was charming. How old is he?
He's 4 years old.
So 8 of the 9 pieces on this recording were written by one of the 2 of the Avitals. Tell me a little bit about how these works came to be. Did you each just kind of go in your own quarters and start writing, or did you start composing together?
A mixture. I remember at the beginning of the process, the creative process, I actually took a flight to New York. I spent a week at Homer's house in Brooklyn, improvising, listening to music, spent hours in front of YouTube and different set music that he brought with him, and I played to him classical stuff, and then we improvised again, and then we went to eat pizza, and then we came back and listened to some more music, and it was a very kind of a week long of just getting to know each other, and many of the tunes were born in that week, especially for me, the tunes that I wrote, which is not... it's not my usual thing. That was a kind of a first time for me to really write in this style, and to compose in general. It was a new experience, and was very interesting to dive into that. Some of the pieces Omer wrote in the past, but like the ballads, Ballad for Ellie, that he wrote for his father after he passed away about 10 years ago, and Lonely Girl. There are 2 beautiful ballads that he couldn't really play with any of his jazz projects that he usually makes. It didn't fit in a jazz project. So they were kind of lying in the drawer. And then when I came that week to New York and played to him that on the mandolin, he says, okay, this is what the music was waiting for. This is a mandolin piece, actually. And so, yeah, a good mixture of that. There's a lot of improvisation also in this album, which also kind of developed through the years that we work together.
You know, that's kind of interesting because I know for classical musicians in general, the idea of improvising is a little bit terrifying, even though classical musicians through the generations had no problem improvising. I mean, if I think of Mozart or Bach, how does that feel for you? Do you feel okay as an improvising musician?
You know, it reminds me back again when we started working together and we're trying to do some classical pieces and so on. And improvisation was new for me. And before going on stage and needing to improvise, I was a little bit panicking every time, talking about maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And I confessed that to Omar. I said, like, and he says, like, why? And I told him, when I have the music in front of me, I cannot do mistakes. I mean, you have the music, and if you play the note at the right time, you cannot do mistakes. And he was like thinking for, you know, a couple of seconds and say, no, this is exactly the opposite for me. I'm panicking when I have to read for music because every note that is printed there is an opportunity to make a mistake. And when I'm improvising, I simply cannot make mistakes. And that was the switch that happened in my brain that moment where I say, okay, there are two ways to look at it. And I think, yeah, now I feel very confident when I go on stage and improvising, but it's really just, yeah, turning a switch in your mind, I think.
One of the things that I think makes you so appealing as a musician and an artist, at least for me, is the fact that the few times that you and I have talked, it's really evident to me that you kind of put your ego on the back burner in order to put the music first. And I know you talked about that when you had to literally relearn how to play the mandolin early on. Remember that? When
yeah,
you went off
true.
To, and you were like, wow, if I would have had any ego about that, I couldn't have done that. And I think that's what allows you to do all these cool things because you're willing to put yourself out there and take the risk. You're a risk taker.
That's for sure. I mean, it interests me, but again, I mentioned it before, this is a simple understanding of my role. When I go on stage, I am there for the people, not the other way around. I am there to serve the people with a beautiful humanistic experience. And that's it. If I forget that, it's a problem.
Let's talk about some of the specific pieces on this new recording. You mentioned the Ballad for Ellie. Tell me about this piece now that we know that it was written for his father.
You know, it's one of my favorite pieces in the record. It was a very special moment in the studio. I remember recording it with tears in my eyes, actually. It's a very emotional piece. Every time we play it, Omar wrote it for his father very briefly after he passed away. 10 years ago, we were friends, so I followed him in this grief. And it's so poetic. I feel that it summarized in music, in notes, a relationship of a father to son. So when I play it, I sometimes think about my father, but I also think about my son. There is so much in the melody of it, of love, of this pure love of a father and a son, between a father and a son, and with some complexities, with some, you know, on its all complexity. I'm having a hard time to put words in it, but that's the beauty about this music. It's so poetic that for me it reflects this whole complexity of father-son relationship in just beautiful music.
On either side of that piece are works that you wrote. Avi's Song, tell me about that. Is that for you?
The name was the most difficult thing I've done in this writing experience. So Avi's Song was probably the first tune that I wrote in my life. It's in 11/8. It's in a kind of a typical Balkan rhythm, which I like very much. I play a lot of Balkan music, and I'm very attached to these odd rhythms. And that was the basis of the tune. It's very rhythmical. But I couldn't find the name to it. And every time we were meeting in the rehearsal, and then in the concerts, and then in the recording studio, I came to the room and said, yes, I call it now, I think once it was Scirocco. And then the next day I said, no, let's call it Layla's Night. And then, no, let's call it something else. And I kept changing the name. And the band stopped taking me seriously, and they just called, let's do Avi's Song, let's record Avi's Song, let's do Avi's Song again. And just the name got stuck to it. And then when the deadline to print the booklet came, and the label called and says, like, Avi, you have to find a name for this tune because we go on print. And I said, oh, you know what, just leave it Avi's Song, it's already there.
Does the prelude serve a different purpose or an additional purpose in this context, or is it just a prelude?
It was thought of being a prelude to the track afterwards, Morocco, which is, again, a tribute to our shared heritage. And so the prelude takes a lot of inspiration for that world, from the Maghreb world, those Arab and improvisational elements in the music. It started as a kind of improvisation that with time got fixed into a quite a solid form, which then I decided to call it prelude, because it really kind of introduces the atmosphere, like a mawal in Arab music would call it, to Morocco, to the next piece that comes afterwards.
Okay, so the next piece after Morocco, you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation of that one.
Hijazin. Hijaz is the name of a mode, Arabic mode. And Hijazin, for each Arab word you add ain, it means like twice that. So Hijazin is a very special mode, which is constructed from these two Hijaz modes. So it's practically just the name of the melodic material, raw material, that Omer worked with to compose this piece. It's very Middle Eastern type of tune.
And then the final track was not written by either of you, and it's actually a ballad. It really does have a folk song quality to it, The Source and the Sea.
Yes. I remember in the last day of the recording, we kind of done with recording ahead of time. We were, it was like 2 p.m. and we said, okay, we're done, we have it all. But we still were very energized and very much wanted to play more and to record more. And we had this time at the studio that was booked for us. And just very spontaneously, I said to Omer, okay, we had this melody that for both of us is kind of a childhood memory. It's an old Israeli tune, the type of tune that both our mothers would turn up the volume in the radio in the kitchen where it was broadcast in the radio. Very popular for that generation. And we just went there without rehearsals, without speaking about the form, and we just played it. And I feel it was like this melody, this childhood memory through our filters, through the journey that we've had, that we've made, each of us, and our relationship to our childhood, to our culture, to our native culture, to Israel. What does it mean? And it's all kind of inside. Also, I mean, the text, it's a song, obviously, and the text is very moving. It's a ballad, it's a legend about a small fountain, source of water, which his sweet water was sweet and shining in the spring days, but he had a wish. He wanted to be big, he wanted to become big like the sea, and to carry golden bridges and ship, and to be mighty and with no borders. And so he asked the god of rivers, make me big, make me the sea. And the god of rivers accepted the wish and led him to the sea. And of course, once the fountain reached the sea swallowed him, lost its sweetness, and lost his song. And that's the kind of, I resonate with it as a mandolin player.
And that's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julie Amacher.